The first case on our docket this morning is number 024118, Connie Sullivan against Robert Ramirez. Ms. Welch.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Ramirez. Your Honor, the First Amendment, the core of the First Amendment, is to assure the free exchange of opinions about political and social issues out in the marketplace of ideas. That core is not implicated here when the speech at issue is secret notes made to protect oneself against accusations of time abuse and to document what is perceived favoritism by a supervisor. Therefore, we ask that this court reverse the entry of the denial of summary judgment here, particularly as to qualified immunity. The threshold of every First Amendment case is that there is speech. And here, there simply wasn't speech.
You may well be right that this isn't the kind of speech under the Pickering-Connick test that's entitled to protection when undertaken by a public employee. But like the district court, I'm a little worried at saying flatly that something that's written down in a diary isn't speech. I mean, Samuel Pepys kept a diary. All sorts of people have kept diaries over the centuries, and the written word is clearly speech. I think your real issue is whether, in the context both of the content and of the manner in which this speech was used, I suppose I might say, was it protected speech?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, we agree that we believe and we've argued that the speech isn't protected, but still I think a core inquiry here is whether there is speech in the first place. Now, no district court, no circuit court has ever really addressed the question of whether uncommunicated writings are in fact speech for First Amendment purposes. And you have to look again at the purpose of the First Amendment, which is to in fact encourage and not prohibit to bar the government from prohibiting communication among particularly on issues of social concern.
Right. I mean, we're having a little bit of a tree fall in the forest kind of discussion,
right.
But taking the record in the light most favorable to the plaintiffs here, which obviously is the way we handle these things, they indicate that the reason they were keeping this record is because the Illinois State Police told them that they wouldn't be able to assess any allegations of improper time use without some kind of documentation. So even though they hadn't gotten around to sharing them yet, the purpose, again, you know, from this specific point of view of the record, was eventual communication. So it seems to me that to call it not speech because it hasn't been shared yet is something I'm uncomfortable with, whether or not, again, at this later point in the process, mm-hmm. we think that for some other reason, perhaps Mr. Ramirez is entitled to qualified immunity.
Right, but just as a final point in this matter, because I think the court's focus probably is on the protected aspect of the speech, that to say that speaking to oneself would be protected speech is again contrary to what the framers were talking about when they wanted to protect the exchange of ideas, to encourage people to get out there and actually speak. Certainly, if the plaintiffs had taken these documents to the state police at any point and conveyed them, or to some investigatory body, there would be no question that there was speech. But until the moment that the speech is actually communicated and communicated voluntarily, there really is not any precedent, certainly, for saying that uncommunicated or involuntarily communicated writings are in fact speech. Which certainly supports the qualified immunity analysis. But then to turn to the question of protection, there are two aspects to this. One is the Connick test, which is this a matter of public concern? Has the plaintiff spoken out as a private citizen on a matter of public concern? And then the Pickering aspect of the protection component is whether the interest in speaking out on a matter of public concern has been shown to outweigh the clear disruptive effect here of any speech that the plaintiffs did make. And certainly, and the speech here fails both aspects of the Connick-Pickering balancing test.
Could I just clarify one point? As I understand, and maybe this is something I should really ask your opponent, as I understand it, the only even potential speech that we're talking about is, in fact, the diaries. We're not talking about this anonymous letter that the plaintiff disclaimed having written anyway, right?
Certainly, Your Honor, I don't think we can talk about the letter because the plaintiff disclaimed it. So certainly, I mean, if even if writings, uncommunicated writings or speech, certainly writings that you don't claim cannot be part of your First Amendment case.
That's my understanding of where we are. So.
Yes, I believe that the plaintiffs disagree with that analysis, but nevertheless. Also, the problem, the more recent of the letters was a year before this occurred, so the temporal connection, the causal connection here is really broken under the normal in Oates and the other retaliation cases. But with regard, so when you, under Connick, what you look at when you're talking about protected speech, whether speech is protected, is you look at the content, you look at the form, and you look at the context. Now here, of course, the form is secret writings. It's not communicated. And that certainly undermines any claim, I believe defeats soundly, any claim that this is protected speech because you're not speaking out at all as a private citizen on a matter of public concern.
Well, what about the point that the plaintiffs make that actually all the events begin occurring once Mr. Ramirez has the diaries in his possession? You know, there comes a time when they are disclosed. They're taken from the drawers. They're taken, and that's when he begins, you know, he suspends them with pay and he takes the other actions that he takes.
But he had already, well, a couple of things. One is that that's involuntary communication, again, which is not, has never been shown by any court to be speech, has been found to be speech by any court. And also, the in fact, he had taken steps before. As soon as he found out that Ms. Sullivan had called to check up on him on the golf court business, right, exactly, he went, you know, he was on his way, you know, to talk to people about what to do. He went to the Labor Relations Department. He said, you know, this has gotten out of hand. These people are checking up on people. They're, you know, everybody, there's a hostile work environment. What can I do? And he was told he could send them home. And in fact, he was told to send them home, that this was a disciplinary matter, there was insubordination. And so he had, before he even saw these documents, he had already decided or been instructed to send them home. So that was the instigation, not the actual seeing of the content.
But no one has ever argued that the phone call to the golf course was in any way a focus of protection.
No.
That I'm aware of, anyway.
No. But there's, I mean, you can't look, again, under the Pickering test or the Connick test, you can't look at this at these records in a vacuum. What you have to do is look at the other evidence, too, about the disruptive effect. And the context here is that the plaintiffs were apparently concerned that there was a double standard, that other people were getting to come in late and were not being disciplined, and they wanted to make, Ms. Sullivan said explicitly at her deposition, I wanted to protect myself in case someone said that I was late and I was going to be disciplined. I wanted to show that other people got off scot-free. And so, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but this was her very own testimony. So when you look at the form, secret notes, you look at the content, which is, again, this is not the kind of thing, this is not Myers, this is not Hedell, this is not about burning toxic waste. This is not about, you know, public health code violations. This is about a couple of people coming in 15 minutes late and taking long lunches. This is a matter of internal agency procedure. The plaintiffs were obviously unhappy that Mr. Ramirez was not running a tighter ship. And that is exactly the kind of thing that is not protected under Connick. You don't protect internal agency matters. And particularly this kind of scale, which doesn't really affect the public as a whole, as a public violation, a health code violation, or a police protection, these sorts of public safety issues.
The plaintiffs argue, though, that it in fact does affect the public as a whole, in that more than one agency of the Illinois state government has been, as you put it, not running a tight ship to the point that the public is paying salaries for people who aren't doing anything. Instead, they're out on golf courses or taking long lunches or otherwise attending personal matters when the state is paying their salaries. And is it your argument that's not a matter of public concern?
Your Honor, my argument is that one of the problems with the notes here is that they weren't all first-hand knowledge. Again, you know, Ms. Sullivan, you know, testified that she got many of her pieces of information from other places. So the notion that, and this is not bribes for licenses. This is not, you know, this is not a payroll or scandal of enormous proportions. This is a Mr. Ramirez favoring some people, not disciplining them, and a fear that they might be disciplined, so they're protecting themselves by keeping these kinds of records. There doesn't seem to be any record of whether people would have working through lunch and making up the 15 minutes. There's a, you know, this is the kind of internal matter that really isn't part of the First Amendment, isn't really conceived of within the First Amendment. And so then, you, in addition to the Connick test, though, you have to look at the Pickering test as well. And does the plaintiff's interest in keeping these notes, not really speaking out for a year, remember, these notes were being kept for a year after the plaintiffs talked to the state police, that their interest in keeping these notes couldn't possibly outweigh the immense disruptive effect. There is much, much testimony in the record as to the hostile work environment that was created here by the plaintiff's conduct. It wasn't just their note keeping.
And implicitly, though, that argument of yours suggests that all the other workers knew that the plaintiffs were keeping these tabs on everybody.
Well, it is, yes, and one of the undisputed facts was that everybody knew,
except there was some communication, in fact. It wasn't utterly secret.
Well,
there was
communication. I mean, the plaintiffs apparently conveyed that they were keeping track of other people. And this is one of the problems about not having the speech communicated. We actually don't, I mean, the other people knew, but they couldn't really know because they'd never seen them. It's like, you know, and the plaintiffs could have been keeping grocery lists for all we knew. I mean, this was part of their sort of terrorist attack on their harassment of other people. They would make comments loud, raucous comments, and this is in the testimony, to other workers when somebody came in late. And this kind of harassment that Mr. Ramirez was told about it, the Cunninghams were told about it, this was, I mean, in their words, a hostile work environment. So when, you know, when Ms. Sullivan made that phone call checking up on Mr. Ramirez, that was the last straw. And that, again, shows the internal nature of this. This isn't about the big kinds of things that the First Amendment was designed to protect. With regard to, I just want to speak briefly about actionable injury. Again, any constitutional claim has to have an injury, and it has to be more than just being yelled at. It has to be, certainly in the Title VII context, in the sex discrimination context, it has to be more than a written reprimand, which is what the most discipline that occurred here.
Well, being escorted out of the building by security officers isn't a pleasant experience, is it, though?
No, surely not, but that happens to, you know, that can happen if you're concerned that someone has records on their computer or so on, and this is something that Mr. Ramirez was concerned about, apparently, because he said, make sure she doesn't take anything off her computer. We don't know that there was anything untoward about this. There's nothing in the record to support that conclusion. And also with regard to causation, it's really black-letter law that a constitutional plaintiff has a plaintiff's constitutional claim has to show that but for their protected conduct, they would have not been adversely affected. I save my time for rebuttal if there are no questions.
Thank you, Ms. Welsh. We'll hear now from Ms. Lee.
May it please the court, counsel, I'd like to take just a moment to point out to the court what the defendant brought to the attention of the district court, because I do think that's important. I included in the plaintiff's appendix the memorandum of law that defendant Ramirez filed regarding his motion for summary judgment. The principles and law of law and argument are found in appendix pages 11 through 18, and of those 8 pages, the principles of law regarding qualified immunity are found at pages 8, 13, and 14. The argument on qualified immunity constituted 11 lines. I find it difficult to see how an argument presented to the district court of 11 lines on the issue of qualified immunity has now grown to the 7 issues found on page 2 of Defendant Ramirez's brief in this court. Somehow it just strikes me that the district court ought to have had the issues now being raised presented to it, and we cite case law to support that. We also believe that the defendant in this court has raised issues he did not raise in the district court, not even remotely raised, and that this court therefore does not have the jurisdiction to review those issues. We have outlined that in our brief. We have also outlined to the court what we believe are issues raised here that do not relate to the issue of qualified immunity.
I think the problem with that perspective that you're taking really can boil down to the way the Supreme Court has instructed us to evaluate qualified immunity claims in Sauté against Katz, where, you know, we of course give your clients, as I was stressing with Ms. Welsh, all of the factual inferences so that there are no factual issues that can pertain, but the court has said the law is never going to develop unless we first take all the facts as the plaintiffs asserts they are and ask whether there is a claim under that set of facts, because if there is no claim, then what are we bothering with? And then once you've done that part of the inquiry, you can move on to the clearly established part of the inquiry. But as I see the state's brief, they're really just fleshing out part one, which under in a qualified immunity appeal, they're entitled to do. And then that's what gets us into all this business about, you know, this Pickering-Connick speech, you know, all of these, it's kind of deconstructing what the first part of the Sauté procedure is what the state has been stressing. Now, of course, if you want to go to clearly established, I have to say this court has had decisions in the qualified immunity area in public employee speech in which we've said this is such a delicate balance and it's so difficult to tell what's internal and what isn't internal that we want to be cautious before we find that something was so clearly established that the individual should be denied qualified immunity. So I don't know if you want to start with clearly established or whether you want to address the arguments that Ms. Welsh was making, but I have to say I'm concerned at that end of the spectrum personally.
Well, what I think we ought to start with is the anonymous letters, the two that have been sent to the Department of Transportation.
Which your clients deny writing.
That is correct, Your Honor. But
so why is that speech protected for them?
Because Defendant Ramirez believed that they or their friends had written those letters. And it is his intent that is at issue in this case. In other words, he believed that Sullivan and Blanco had written the letter. I think it was 10 months before the events in question in this case. He also kept separate.
Do you have a case that says that? When somebody believes that somebody else has said something, that it's their free speech rights, even though they disclaim having said it?
Your Honor, I believe the case law supports that it is the intent of the defendant. In other words, he believed that they had written that anonymous letter that triggered the state police investigation. He kept special files on those two employees.
But why do we have to begin there if the applicable constitutional standard, if the balance you're arguing for between internal management of the workplace and speech rights, giving you all the benefits of the doubt on the protected nature of the speech, nonetheless is unclear, then under qualified immunity principles, you know, a tie goes to Mr. Ramirez, a tie goes to the granting of qualified immunity, because public employees are not supposed to hold their job with the sword of Damocles hanging over them if they miss something that's still under development in the law.
Well, Your Honor, let me then go to the fact that both plaintiffs met with the state police during their investigation. It was pointed out to them that there was no documentation to match when employees were present in that bureau and match that to the official time.
Right, and I already discussed that with Ms. Welsh, but why does that answer the question I just asked you?
because the calendar that they were keeping was part of the whole process.
Why is Mr. Ramirez supposed to know that people who are keeping potentially inaccurate records of time and attendance, who don't have access to leave files, who don't have access to information about who's on flex time and who isn't, who don't have access to lots of other information, why is he supposed to know that he can't discipline somebody for meddling in the workplace that way?
Well, I think Your Honor is assuming when you talk about meddling in the workplace that the defendant's version of the facts is true.
I'm asking how is he supposed... He perceives it as meddling in the workplace. You perceive it and your clients perceive it, and we'll assume that you're right. We'll assume it's speech. But he is also aware, and now under Connick, that just because it's speech doesn't mean that the state has to stop being an employer. The state can still be an employer, and it can still regulate to a certain degree what its employees do. And it's that balance you're saying, if Mr. Ramirez got it wrong, even by an inch, he's liable. And I'm asking you how you find that under the qualified immunity standard, where the law actually has to be at a reasonable degree of certainty, see Anderson against Creighton, clearly established.
I believe that the law in this circuit has protected whistleblowers, and we cited those cases, all of which involved records, in our brief. Now, everyone knew, when we talk about whether or not this is speech and protected speech, everybody knew, according to the defendant, that the plaintiffs were keeping these records. Ramirez read those records and then took the action that he took. So he based it upon their speech. Now, we think that abuse of state time is a very serious wrong. That if you just take people coming in 15 minutes late a day, we're up to over 60 hours a year.
But of course, we don't know if anybody was abusing state time based on these plaintiffs' records. All we know is when people were coming and going, if we believe every sentence in the record. But we don't know if that was okay or not. People have sick hours, people have leave hours, people have all sorts of other things.
That's right, but if you will recall, there is a section in the brief that during the grievance proceedings that the plaintiff Sullivan was allowed to see certain records, and there were problems with abuse of time. Both plaintiffs reported to Cunninghams, and there's two Cunninghams in the case.
Son, right.
And both plaintiffs reported the abuse of time to their supervisors, and in fact, action was taken in regard to at least one employee for her abuse of state time due to those reports. So it's not simply the notes. It has to be viewed in the complete context of the state police investigation, what the plaintiffs were told during that investigation, their reports to their immediate supervisors.
But why was it their job to do, if they were doing that, if they were serving as supplemental timekeepers for the office, were they doing the job they were hired to do, or were they themselves also failing to give the state the time they should have?
I think the record is clear that they were making these notes on their lunch hours, on their breaks, and after work. There is no evidence that they were abusing their time. I mean, Mary Blanco, I know a lot's been said about state employees, but Mary Blanco was an excellent employee who had served the state for over 30 years. And to have her walked out by security under those circumstances in front of those people at IDOT was really an outrage for what she had been doing. She was trying to serve the state, and instead she ended up being punished for doing that. We believe that the conduct, the keeping of the notes, was protected by the First Amendment. We also believe that those notes were published, not only by the reports to the supervisors, but also by Ramirez himself reading them. There is no question that he took the action against these women based upon what he had read in those notes, and based upon his belief that these two women were trying to identify wrongdoing within his bureau. In the last year, the public has come to recognize the value of whistleblowers I believe that the circuit has long recognized the value of whistleblowers and given them First Amendment protection. I would only say what Judge McDade said in his opinion. To give effect to Ramirez's argument would be rewarding behavior, stifling speech. The judge identifies certain factual issues to be determined by the jury, and we ask that this court allow the plaintiff to proceed to trial by jury. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. Ms. Welsh, you have 2 minutes.
I have just a few points. First is that Judge McDade was incorrect in his assessment of there being factual questions. These are questions of law here, and particularly when a defendant accepts the plaintiff's version of the facts for purposes of summary judgment, there is no question of fact. It becomes, again, a question of law, and both whether a particular writing might be speech is a pure question of law. We're not disputing any of the facts here. What we're disputing is the legal consequences of those facts, and those are legal questions, including, in particular, whether the speech is protected. As the Supreme Court said in Connick, this is a question of law. And under Pickering, I think it's extremely important for courts to give deference, and they give deference to government when it's acting as an employer, when it even predicts a disruptive effect from speech. And here there is very strong evidence of actual disruptive effects, not just from the note-taking, although there was, and we cited case law to support the notion that this kind of secret note-taking is inherently disruptive, but also to the harmony of the workplace. But also, you have to look at the context of these notes within all the plaintiff's conduct, and what they were doing was creating this sort of reign of terror, so that one employee even felt that they had to transfer out of there because they were so unhappy about the plaintiff's conduct. So again, because we're accepting plaintiff's version of the facts, but plaintiff's version of the facts simply doesn't make out, as Judge Wood pointed out, the first prong. I'm sorry, I didn't mean that you said that, but that there's a first prong to the qualified immunity analysis. The plaintiffs didn't make that out with their evidence, and certainly with regard to the second prong, there's no case law out there that says that private writings are speech, or that when a supervisor reasonably perceives that there's a very disruptive effect, that they cannot take some steps to restrict speech.
Thank you.
General questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Welsh. The court thanks both.